Bill Hamilton. Let's tell our audience a little bit about what Project Aquarius is really all about.
Project Aquarius has been known for a while in the UFO research community. It is allegedly an umbrella named project for all alien related activities, the study of extraterrestrial biological entities, their history, their agenda, their involvement with us on Earth, and phases of it deal with their technology and attempts to understand their technology for the purpose of reverse engineering it. There are a lot of sub-projects under Project Aquarius. There's been many attempts to try to verify Project Aquarius is a UFO-related project. Most of, since there's many projects that are named Aquarius, it isn't the only Aquarius project, apparently, and this confuses people. But we do have now at least one document that's been released through the Freedom of Information Act of John Greenwald.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, based on Project Aquarius, that is UFO related. It's around 1982 or 83, I believe, document pertaining to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So we know that there is a UFO related Project Aquarius.
Now in your book, do you deal with the Dan Burrish affair much?
Yes, specifically since Dan stated that he worked under the umbrella of Project Aquarius, and it's also written into the document that he co-authored when he was up at the Nevada test site, that we simply refer to as the Q94 document. The 94 refers to the year 1994 that it was written. Then there's -109- this kind of, you know, A. This was a draft document that we have in our possession. And it concerns studies, biological studies on a cellular level of an extraterrestrial biological entity known to the research team as J-Rod.
You know, the first interview that you and I did in, back in 99 or 2000, right in that area, you came right out of the blue with this J-Rod story. I think that's about the time, I guess you've been actually investigating Area 51 since the 70s, but when were you aware of this J-Rod?
I first became aware of the term J-Rod, or the name J-Rod, I didn't know which, from a man that I met in 1995 by the name of Bill Uhouse. And Bill's story was, he was a retired Marine, by the way, that had gotten into the aviation field. He was a mechanical engineer, and of course the aviation field uses mechanical engineers and electronic engineers and aerospace engineers of all kinds, because we're talking about integrated systems. And he got into the specialty of flight simulators, building flight simulators so that pilots can learn how to fly new airplanes, you know, to control them before they get into the actual airplane and test fly them. Right? And he was recruited again by one of these secret, top secret projects to build a flight simulator for a flying saucer.
Yeah.
So during his briefing into that particular project, which had been centered at Los Alamos National Laboratories, he was informed about a number of things. And that was that the saucer technology was a gift of our friends. Practically all of these people who work on these projects refer to these extraterrestrial visitors as our friends.
It's kind of a generic description, and everybody knows what you're talking about.
Yes. So our friends, apparently, we have not only retrieved craft that had some kind of flight systems failure, in other words, a crashed disc, like the Roswell event, but they have actually given to us as a gift some of their technology to examine. And we do not understand it fully because their physics is not our physics. And eventually our scientists had to learn how to discard approaching the problem from the standpoint of our theories and start from scratch and do a lot of observations and what have you.
The interesting thing about that is they give it to us as a gift without the instruction book, huh?
Well, primarily it's up to us to understand the functioning of the device through our own means so that we can relate to it. I mean, you know, we're educated in a certain way, and we have to, it's almost like doing a language translation.
Now, when you talk to Uhouse about this, and he mentioned J-Rod the first time, is that right?
Well, he said that the advisor, the scientific advisor on this project involving the simulator was, this was almost the time to break out in laughter when you heard that the boss was an extraterrestrial, right? And that not only that, that he attended a meeting at Los Alamos. Well, not Bill Uhouse, but he had heard of this meeting in which some of the scientists and one of the Majestic members was present by the name of Dr. Edward Teller and about a dozen other scientists, and J-Rod was there at the table with him wearing a long sleeve shirt.
Mm-hmm.
See, he was maybe about, I believe 5 feet, maybe 5 feet, 2 inches tall. In other words, he was the height of many humans, okay? However, he looked quite different. And when he spoke to you in response to some question, the question would, or the answer would be returned to you hearing your own voice in your head.
So he doesn't physically speak, you just grasp it mentally somehow. You could hear your own voice answering.
Exactly, because even though I understand some of them make sounds, these sounds aren't directly, you know, this is like listening to a dolphin or something.
Okay.
Another thing is they have hand gestures, they communicate with gestures or sign language. But
And for our audience, are we talking about a typical gray or a modification of that? I mean, what's the real?
Well, the J-Rod could be called a gray, yes. It is not the only variation. And this has also led to a lot of confusion. There are different variations.
Yeah, and I want to find that and pursue that a little bit later, but I'm really interested in the fact that I guess J-Rod is not the name of one single individual.
It's a category.
Yes, a race of people.
Because, again, he was making gestures indicating a symbol. And if we looked at the symbol looked like our letter J, but kind of flattened at the bottom, and beside it, a horizontal bar, okay, which you can call a rod, so shortened to J-Rod. It so happens that the symbols that he used seem to reproduce in an ancient language a number. And the number that it reproduces is the number 15. So J-Rod actually is a nomenclature that would be something like the word we use, 15, to denote a number. And the reason that number is used is because he came from a world 15 light years from our solar system, which was used as a staging base. It was not his origin. It was a staging base where they met with another race of beings.
And then they came to this solar system and came to Earth?
Yeah, it was, in other words, this particular planet, which has been designated in our catalog as Gliese 876c, has been known by our astronomers for some time, that the Gliese 876 system has two planets. And recently, and this is remarkable, just this year, they announced the discovery of a third planet in the Gliese 876 system, which is a rocky planet similar to the planet Earth.
Now, when the first information about J-Rod came forward from this former Marine, U-House, you probably had a little trouble assimilating it. I would, at least. This is a complicated story.
Actually, yes. And, of course, other than remarks that U-House made about engineering, and like some engineers, not like all engineers, but some engineers are, their way of thinking, their graphical or even mathematical way of thinking, does not lend itself too well to articulation. So Bill was not a great articulator.
Yeah, I understand that. We had a little discussion among our staff, researchers, and producers about you, and you're an interesting fellow that you think like that. You're a scientific fellow, but I guess over the years you've learned how to articulate and communicate. So you're a little bit of both.
Well, there are scientists who speak quite well. I mean, they're clear communicators.
But many of them do not. They really kind of, it's kind of like a formula, you know?
Well, yeah. But you see, you have to understand communication itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand that the purpose of communicating an idea is to convey that idea so that it is comprehended or understood by the receiving mind that's receiving that idea, right?
So this entity that was helping us or helping Mr. U-House and others simulate this flying saucer craft, did he come here on his own, or was he? I've heard that stories about the Cayman crash. Is that where he came from? Or?
Well, some of the, as I understand it, the original J-Rods, there were four of them that were recovered from the Cayman crash, and I'm not too certain about this, but whether only two of them survived or all four of them survived. I do not believe they were the only ones either that had come here. And my understanding now is these J-Rod's home world in our present era, okay, is Zeta Reticuli, the fourth planet of Zeta Reticuli 2. And at least this is what Bill U-House seemed to agree to, and this is what even mentioned by Bob Lazar, and then again by Dan Burish, is something he read in what he called the King Tut books, which were briefing manuals.
Why did he call them the King Tut books?
I'm not sure,
yeah.
But they have little insider
I mean, I have
colloquialisms that they use.
Right. I haven't met Dan Burish, but you have him.
Right. In other words, he doesn't talk about the underground facility at S4. He calls it the Shady Rest.
So underground.
Shady indeed. Yes, see, it has a kind of a double connotation.
Sure. And so when we're talking about this. These people have come, or these entities have come, and they've made, or have they made some sort of deal with us, or what is the situation?
Well, the situation is, it was found out that in particular the J-Rods, not particularly any other race.
Yeah, there's others evidently.
There's others, there's somebody related to the J-Rods that look more like us. Okay, they're Nordic types. And there are others beyond that who are true extraterrestrials born on foreign worlds who are coming to the Earth. However, the J-Rods and this other race, even though they are extraterrestrial in the sense of their home planet is not Earth, they originated on Earth.
Yeah, I understand that's part of the
And they come to us
story.
from our future, and this is the part that, you know, for instance, Dr. Bob Wood here
Yes.
is very fascinated now in the idea and the scientific studies that are going on time travel, which I've studied, and he coming from a more grounded area of engineering and physics, and the idea that there is time travel, it seems a little startling. How could this be? This sounds like it would create too many paradoxes. However, if you study the mechanics, space travel itself, with extremely fast velocities, interstellar travel, that space travel and time travel go together, hand in hand. And this simply falls out of the time dilation equations in the theory of relativity, which says that the time itself, like if you have a second of time here that's passing on Earth, mm-hmm. and you have a spacecraft taking off from Earth going to nearby Alpha Centauri, okay, and it reaches velocities, let's say 95% of what we measure as the speed of light, okay, that a second takes much longer to tick, okay, when we see this. So that instead of, you know, like Alpha Centauri is about 4.3 light years mm-hmm. distant. Well, instead of taking at that velocity 4.5 years, let's say, to reach Alpha Centauri, they may reach there in less than a year. So the idea is if there are twins, and this is called the twin paradox, that there are twins, and one of the twins works in the Houston Space Center, and the other twin is the astronaut that goes to Alpha Centauri, and he goes there and he turns around and he comes back.
The first twin that stayed here is much older.
Exactly. He is older because for him, now there's been an elapsed time of, well, it took the guy, you know, according to his measurements, 4.5 years to get there, 4.5 years to get back. Well, that's 9 years. Let's say the time the astronaut experience was about a year to get there and a year to come back. So only 2 years has passed. He's only 2 years older because biology has its own clock and will also slow its rate.
Right, yeah, it sounds very complicated, but on another hand, it's fairly simple. If you're in this capsule moving someplace near the speed of light or whatever, time has slowed down, elongated itself.
But in practical reality, if this really happened, of course we haven't proven it because we haven't done it, but if the astronaut came back 9 years later, and for him only 2 years has passed, he's effectively traveled to the future.
Yes.
He skipped ahead.
Well, that brings me up to this book that Dan Burrish wrote back there with B.J. Wolf and a third party who I don't know.
Right, right.
It was basically going to Mars, I believe, and seeing something there, 2020 AD, is that right?
Well, that he saw structures
yes.
that now exist on Mars.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The paradox.
I mean, is this a fiction book or?
No, this is a real study that Dan did.
Okay.
He did it prompted by communications he had with the J-Rod.
Okay.
Communications in which the J-Rod could show him images. The only way that I could, that we could simulate what these images were like is not just images in your mind, okay, but as if this room was turned into a holodeck, right, like on Star Trek.
Yes.
Okay, then you have scenes running like a virtual reality. You can actually reach out and touch things, interact with holodeck images. It's supposed to be a hologram, right? Well, in the same way, J-Rod had this tremendous advanced mental facility to place Dan inside a virtual reality.
you could do it without the...
Without the mechanism.
Yes, okay.
Simply by mind power. And he showed him these images of Mars, and this is why he pursued the research.
And there seems to be some reason why we haven't really gone to certain places on Mars, and maybe if we know more than we're supposed to know, huh? What's the deal? What's your feeling about it?
Well, this is speculation.
Yeah, I understand.
There's a lot of talk about it, but I have been in contact with another person who has inside knowledge, who once worked for NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an engineer by training, but also very, very interested in the UFO subject. And he tells me that NASA is, there are compartments like anywhere else within NASA who have, and he was in one of these compartments who had advanced clearances for advanced space missions where they sent out probes to the edge of the solar system that are not known by the public.
Mm.
And these probes, furthermore, were sent out by, under the aegis of the National Security Agency. And one begins to wonder, what interest does an intelligence gathering agency have in sending probes beyond Saturn? Right? Unless, and what could they possibly listen to in the form of electronic messages out around Saturn that would make any sense to them? Well, according to him, NASA is well aware that there are over 160 civilizations out there that have made some form of contact with us over time.
160.
Yeah. Probably about 165 or 160. Well, an engineer I talked to said 167. The two numbers are so close that I would add. There have been other numbers coming out from other people that are much lower than this, but these two came into a very close agreement.
That's a lot of different species contacting us.
Right.
They seem to be all in unison. They all are doing it in secret, at least.
Yeah, and again, I have to make the statement that there is no present way that I can authenticate information like that. So what I do is I correlate the information from independent sources to see if some of the information agrees. And when it does, this raises the possibility that the information may be authentic.
Couple of things that I think of immediately, Bill, is first of all, how did you come across the Dan Burrish story? I guess you met BJ or something.
Well, what happened was she had posted that she had a document on the internet. This was back in 1999, and she had excerpts from this particular document we call the Q94, and I was looking at it, and one of the things that I read in the document was that it was a, it involved the extraction of tissue samples from an extraterrestrial biological entity designated AQ-J-Rod. So I saw the J rod there. I didn't know what the AQ was, but the AQ was for Aquarius.
Okay.
And, this was authored by, at the bottom, there were two names on it. One name was, principal investigator was Dr. Danny B. Crane, Captain USN. And it was a draft. But when I noticed the J-Rod, I said, wait a minute. J-Rod, that's what Bill Uhouse talked about. And I selected this out simply for the reason that if one person mentioned J-Rod and a second person mentioned J-Rod, could I find more people who had some kind of inside work that would verify the existence of J-Rod? Well, now I have
eight people.
So that's pretty strong. None of them have denied the existence of at least one J-Rod. So this is what attracted me to it. And the other part of it was this paper seemed to be highly technical in its content, and that attracted me because I'd never seen a technical paper. Usually it's a report. If you look at the Majestic documents, you see reports, you know, progress report.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what have you. There's some scientific data in there, but not much. Well, this was a scientific report, and it was done in a certain form, a briefing form, and it was a draft copy of it. And so I got hold of her, and I sent for, because the original leak was photocopied in reverse, and you could not easily read it. I sent away for that, and it's a translation, so that you could, you know,
yes,
it was readable. And it also had the logo of the Naval Space Command on it.
Now, we know her real name now. That's a pen name, right?
Right. Her real name is Marcia McDowell.
And you've known her since 99, I guess.
Well, only by email. And it wasn't until 2002 when I tried to get more responses from her, but it seemed like she was unwilling and reluctant to make contact with UFO researchers until she was at a point where...
It makes you wonder why that one thing was on the forum.
She was trying to get some attention because she felt that Dan was being abused.
Well, we will probably get into that because there's been a lot of people that, you know, I just mentioned the name Dan Beresh, and I get 8, 9, 10 emails saying, hey, what are you talking about him for?
Right.
I've never really seen as much people questioning things, just like, how did they get into challenging his degree at SUNY, for instance? I mean,
the same way that Bob Lazar, you know, claimed that he had a master's degree in physics, and the only verification of any degree that Bob Lazar has is an AA degree from Pierce College, where I went too, by the way. So there's no proof, in other words, that Lazar has an engineering or science degree of any kind. You cannot verify it. Well, he's not the only one. I met a guy named Dan Woolman. You can prove he's an engineer, but you can't prove he's a physicist because his advanced degree is not acknowledged by the university either. Dan Beresh's degree is not acknowledged by State University in New York either. And I wrote, I checked out, I have a lot of documents on the Dan Beresh case, and I wrote to SUNY, and no, we don't have on record a student by that name or an individual by that name. However, I came to find out, because I work at UCLA, that a student who doesn't want public access to his records, a student can sign a form, a privacy form, of barring access to verification that he went to a certain university. Now, if a student can do this by law, what about an intelligence agency? What if a CIA agent was sent to school and the CIA doesn't want anybody to know that this person went to the school?
Right? I have, and you know more about that since you work for a major university. I've often wondered, I've been told before, police agencies and federal agencies, investigating agencies, FBI, et cetera, they can probably go get the information, but it's pretty tough on other people if they don't want you to know it. In other words, if a student signs a statement, nobody can find anything else.
So, actually, what I've had to settle for are notarized statements.
And you have some, and you have some interesting documents.
Which state that people know that he had received a degree because they had seen that early on.
What's his reaction when you ask him things like that? Did you really get a because a lot of people are saying, hey, this was just a corrections officer.
Well, you know, I'll tell you how serious he is about it.
Okay.
The reason, you know, the book I told you about, Mars,
yes. Uh-huh.
That's when they yanked any verification of his degree. Majestic did that. I mean, they just they paid for his education there in the first place anyway.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Unknown to his mother, he did go there for 9 particular workshop sessions. But it was highly unorthodox that they were, and they were paid, 3 professors, and I have their names, were paid to come out here and give him oral exams. And he's an extremely bright man. He has a second degree, by the way, now, in biological systems, PhD. Okay. He's not exposing that, and he doesn't want that record erased right now. But there's a way through a back door that I don't want to discuss in any detail toward verifying that he indeed had a PhD from SUNY, and the way we're going about that is in secret right now, but he is willing to even go forward and file a lawsuit if necessary to get attention. Now, whether Majestic will say, you know, send down a communication to him and say, well, you know, Dan, you don't have to go that far.
Okay, so when
there are ways, in other words, right, that we're attempting, and he is willing to go so far as to file a lawsuit if necessary, at which time, I guess, you know, he does found ways of applying pressure on the overseers, so to speak, sometimes to get his way, right, to get something he wants.
Now you guys met with him recently, and you've done a video interview with him at one time that some people have seen.
Right.
And what kind of guy is he?
Dan is just a regular guy. I mean, he is a guy who's got a good sense of humor, quick wit, and almost eidetic memory. Can rattle off scientific and technical terms quicker than you can say, wait, hold it, I need a dictionary, right? I have seen him perform tasks on microscope. He's an expert in microscopic work. He was one of the youngest members of the Los Angeles Microscopical Society.
He has a degree from UNLV, too, right?
Yes, he has a degree from UNLV.
And did he get his master's there?
No. No, he just recently got transcripts about his master's, which was at a seminary, believe it or not.
Okay, that explains an email I ran across where he's a Doctor of Divinity, maybe.
I think he just got an MA.
Okay.
From a seminary. Because at one time he wanted to be a Catholic priest because he experienced what we would call like kind of a miracle healing from a Catholic priest.
Now, what did he have wrong with him, or do you know, or is it even important? I'm just kind of serious.
He was a teacher, something like that.
I'm not sure exactly
what, but he was going blind, what have you, and that would be an extremely impairing ability to have, right? Yeah. Especially if you're looking through a microscope.
Yeah, yes, if your work deals with that.
But he has no problem with his vision today.
Now, it's interesting that he was interested in the Catholic religion, correct?
Yes, because it was his mother brought him to a Catholic priest.
And now we talk about this key to life that he has now. It's called the Garnish or Ganesh?
Ganesh particle. The Lotus product.
Yes, and that really, that name, I believe, comes from a Hindu religion.
Exactly. Well, he extracted these particles initially at ancient bedrock up here at Frenchman Mountain. Okay, there's what's called the Great Unconformity. And the bedrock is 700 million years old, which goes back to about the Precambrian era. Okay, and extracting these particles from there, from Vishnu schist, what is called Vishnu schist. Well, the word Vishnu suggested to him that he should, to identify something brand new that he was seeing under the microscope, he started using terms from Hindu mythology. Okay, so Ganesh particle is one of them. There's also the pearls of Brahma, okay, that he has seen under microscope. One thing where he departed from this is an object that he terms a Selkie, after Greek mythology, okay? But the whole thing, and I have seen...
Now, he goes up there quite often to this area we were just talking about.
Yes.
He kind of gets renewed there, and he's found something very interesting. We talked to you about the Phoenix Lights, and there's this glaze on some mountains down there, too, coating or something. Are we talking about portals or something, you think?
Well, yeah, he sees what we could term micro portals. At least that's what we think they are.
Yeah.
You could see them on the video. There's a flashlight when they open up.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the emergence of this concatenation of particles, okay? And when the Ganesh particle comes out, when he's doing a testing of this, he will place a test sample, like an injured or damaged cell, close to the portal. And when the Ganesh particle comes out, led by the Selkie, it determines exactly where the injured area in the cell is. And then it builds a cross bridge into that area, and presto, like magic, the cell is repaired.
Now, he came across this when through J-Rod.
Yes.
The basic research came from there.
Well, yeah. Initially, he called it Mission Genesis. How did life start on Earth?
Now, let's talk a little bit about, if we can, Marcia. There seems to be a lot of religious significance in some of these writings. And was she like Dan, going to be something in the religious field originally?
No, she has a different perspective. Comes from a different background on it.
I was reading her.
Dan's migrated more into mysticism.
Yes.
More than anything else.
And it doesn't seem like Marcy's followed him on that. Or maybe she has
by
now.
They're both interested, for instance, in the subject of sacred geometry. Because what they're seeing, and if you look at these video images, you could see outlines of Platonic solids appearing. Like the icosahedron, or dodecahedrons, and especially the octahedrons. And octahedral crystals are stimulated by a certain electrical voltage, and this is what apparently, it's kind of a hit and miss thing right now, but this is what produces, encourages the micro portals to open up. And I've been doing some speculation from the physics side of it, and introduced the research going on with biophotons to Dan, and he has now incorporated that into the LOTUS project, the biophotons.
Well, in other words, you and Dan Burrish have a good relationship. You can even suggest things along.
But see, I want to explore this with some instruments myself while it's taking place, and he's a little bit leery of having me do that at the present time, simply because there are certain tones involved, okay? And these tones, and I've seen only images on this, but I've talked to the witnesses, certain combinations of tones can be extremely destructive as well as constructive, okay? You get the wrong combination, and it can be so destructive that if the military mind sees this, they're going to say, look at this. We want all of your records on this. We want to see what's doing this. We want to see if we can reproduce this, because this would be an excellent weapon.
So
he won't let that happen.
Yeah, I started to say, it seems to me that he's in the government, paid his way to SUNY. I guess they sent him to Area 51 after that, or what? I mean, how did that happen?
Well, he was up at the TTR originally, okay, and then to Area 51, Groom Lake, for a while, and then over to the Papoose Mountain facility, R4800. So, and he spent time down there. Now very few people have access to the level he had access. It's very controlled. And I mean, it's like this. Okay, here's two red lines. Here's a blue line. You walk along that blue line. You don't stray over the red line. You stray over the red line, and you go to the cemetery. That's your next stop.
Yeah.
Okay, because they have Navy SEALs. Ryan O'Connor, or Connor, whatever his name was, Connor, was one of the SEALs that talked to Wendell Stevens. That
yes.
was also at SEAL.
Uh-huh.
You probably are familiar with that story. But definitely, SEALs are the Navy. Okay, the Navy is in control of these projects there. And they've gained more and more control because they're one of the oldest services. They have seniority, Naval Space Command, Naval Research Labs. You'll see Naval Intelligence.
Navy Intelligence was right off the bat. They got interested.
And then there's this Department of Naval Intelligence, which you can't find whether it exists or not, because the regular Naval Intelligence is called the ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence. See, so this is like a shadow.
Did Dan ever tell you the first time that he came up on J-Rod at Area 51? I mean...
Well, they didn't tell him about it. They simply had him doing microscopic work and looking at cellular or tissue samples, okay? And they had an automatic system. They had, you know, there's like a conveyor belt, okay? And they can't reach out and touch the samples. The sample passes to their station. They have a keyboard, and the keyboard controls the lenses, okay? Well, he got very frustrated with that type of work after 6 months because they wouldn't answer certain questions. Where did these samples come from? I've never seen cells that look like this. And he was trained in cellular biology, right? And he's seen a kind of cellular metabolism that's taking place that includes a chemistry that's not common to any life on Earth. So that's why he was pressing, where did you get these cells from, right? And after a while, they just let him go. In other words, well, you know, go take R&R, you know. And then they brought him back. And when they brought him back, that's when they said, sit in this room, very similar to Bob Lazar, you know, and read these books. Well, there were books on everything. Well, propulsion, he's not interested in that, right? Yeah. He just stuck to the biology, right? So, and that's where he learned, here's the origin of this entity was Zeta Reticuli 2,
yeah.
right, Planet 4. But it wasn't until later that he found out, Zeta Reticuli 52,000 years from now. And that was a startling revelation.
Okay. Well, it would be.
Yeah. that this being here had traveled back in time because his people originally came from Earth.
Now the theory here that we're talking about is these people came back to Earth now. Why? Because there's going to be a major event happening?
Because the catastrophic event that happened split the human genome and divided the, and what happened is that it created the time loop also. The process of time travel, convergent time travel, creates a loop. And it overlays a timeline with another timeline. In other words, it's a modification that's, you would have to understand what happens in the realm of quantum mechanics and the collapse of the wave function. When there's a collapse of the wave function, probability that manifests itself is a new probability. And that probability replaces the reality that was there with a new reality. Okay. Now, what they've been trying to do is fix it.
So they still exist. Is that right?
Yeah, so that
I mean,
they're trying to fix it so that the split doesn't occur. The genomic split doesn't occur.
And then what would happen to them? I mean, it looks like they would change.
They would remain as they are. They would remain as they are. We would remain as we are. And a greater portion of humanity would survive. And for a greater portion of humanity to survive, we have had to have the help of actual other extraterrestrial civilizations that have the technology to minimize the destruction that's coming from our sun.
And the way I understand it, probably what we're talking about here, over 35,000 years or so, the magnetic pole shifts,
precession of the equinox.
Yeah, and as and basically, we don't have protection from the solar flares.
Well, see, apparently there are.
I'm trying to get it into where all of us can understand.
Yeah, well, there are cycles. Okay, a study that I've been doing. In fact, I'm going to be going on another radio show simply about the cycles of time. And there are minor cycles and major cycles and grand cycles, right? My estimation is we're coming up on a confluence of minor and major cycles, so that the threat zone or the threat level is much greater than it was, let's say, during the last catastrophic period of about 11,500 years ago, roughly.
So are we talking about the time period where Homo sapiens went to Homo sapiens sapiens, or?
No.
Okay, this is later.
This is more recent history.
Okay.
This is the time period of the destruction of the legendary Atlantis, you know, that kind of period of time when something catastrophic happened to the Earth. We're talking about the possibility of a magnetic pole shift. And I have found at least one professor who says that the magnetic shift can take place as rapidly as he's found evidence of a 30-day period when the polarity shifted in Oregon, in the iron mountains of Oregon, right?
If it can
happen that rapidly, just the magnetic shift alone is somewhat catastrophic. But what we're seeing now is a change in the thermalicity of the sun, a change in the planets of the solar system. They're all undergoing global warming. We're seeing a change in the Earth, where the internal heat-producing factory of the Earth is bubbling to the surface, and we're seeing the melting of the Arctic ice cap. We're seeing the disintegration of the Antarctic ice cap. We're going to see, not only does the ocean water heat up from this source of heat, but it expands in volume. And if it expands in volume, then low-lying areas, let's say the state of Florida, for instance, which is all very low-lying, and could be inundated, could be totally inundated by the ocean within years. And now there are scientists who are seriously disturbed by what they see is happening. And, of course, the thermal gradients in the ocean are such that it's feeding these hurricanes. It's fueling them up, and that's why we're seeing these Category 5s. And, of course, tonight on television, they're going to show this science fiction scenario called Category 7, the end of the world, right?
You spoke about television. CBS has a new series on Friday nights. I forget the name of it, but it's very similar to the whole Dan Burrish affair, right? Yes.
Yeah.
It's very similar to a lot of the things we're talking about.
Threshold, and there's one called Invasion on Wednesday nights that's very, very good. There's an outbreak of these kind of programs right now that are very interesting, and I have been informed of certain other programs that are in the works that are being guided, so to speak, toward.
Yeah, we haven't really gotten into this part of it, but I mean, your theory is, and we'll continue this conversation at another time. But your theory is that there's what, or maybe you believe it.
Well, it's not my theory. It's that there are certain claims being made that we're undergoing changes. We know we're undergoing climate changes that some scientists think are. Changes that will accumulate over a half a century to a century.
But
what I'm talking about is a catastrophic change that takes place all at once.
But I mean, if J-Rod came from the future, then he told Dan or somebody
exactly
what's happened.
Well, yeah, it wasn't just Dan.
And it's more natural than man-made.
Natural, yes.
And
it's a natural consequence of the journey of our solar system through the galaxy. 250 million years ago. Okay, which is one grand year, one circuit around the galaxy for our sun and family of planets, there was a major extinction event on the Earth, or what they call an ELE, okay, yes. An extinction-level event, whereby at least 90% of ocean life and 75% of land life was extinguished. What caused it? Okay, and that's the search is on now. There is a desperate search going on as to whether we are going to experience another ELE or not, and what's causing it. And you don't want to panic the public while you're doing your research, right? But more and more people are becoming aware.
Well, I think the public is beginning to accept, especially of just this summer season and the tsunami last year and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that there's some natural changes going on.
Look at that tremendous underwater quake in Sumatra, and,
yes.
And the fact that nearby is a super volcano, and we have one right here in the States, in Yellowstone. And there was a documentary on what
yes.
would happen if the Yellowstone super volcano were to erupt. Well, you could say shut the doors on the United States commerce and everyday life and the economy and everything else because of the devastation.
Yeah, so. What is a Majestic 12, and then there's another group, I'll call them the Illuminati for the international part. That's probably not the same Illuminati we've talked about.
No, but that's a good name as any. Let's just say there are factions.
Yeah.
There are multiple factions.
I mean, why wouldn't they want people to be aware of this? I mean, there's a lot of great deal of money to be made.
You can save a lot of people, but you can't save all of the people. Unless they got a new plan. I mean, they do have underground shelters, deep underground shelters. They could shelter people for... and there's people already living, as I understand it, in these underground cities that have been constructed to provide them with all the amenities of life for a period of time, at least a period of time that will get them through the catastrophic period.
How many people, and this would be a corporate or a government or a United Nations?
I would say both.
How many people know about this, you think?
Enough people that I can get information on it, but not all everyone knows about it. We know about underground facilities that are used for various purposes, research, materials, military, whatever, you know, like Cheyenne Mountain is just an insane.
I can't let you go without asking you, and there's so many other things we'll do in future shows about this, but... when Dan saw J-Rod the first time, did he ever see him face-to-face?
Oh, well, yeah, but he was suited up. He was in encapsulated.
Right, because J-Rod had, another type of atmosphere?
Because the atmosphere that he was then breathing supported a metabolism that would not support human metabolism. It would be toxic to us.
But he would...
His metabolism...
He would survive in that. In other words...
Yeah,
the J-Rod types are...
they weren't always like that. They changed.
They just kind of changed to adapt to wherever they went.
Right. Even the ones from half that distance in time were okay and could have walked. For instance, the one Bill Uhouse saw was perfectly comfortable.
Yeah, he was setting an office in Los Alamos.
Exactly.
Wonder how he got there.
But he did not come from the... as far in the future as the J-Rod that Dan had was examining, because 7,000 years, in fact, separates the two J-Rods. And at that point, a deterioration started in. And they will go extinct unless they correct whatever... the genetic factors are,
and
they can be corrected.
And it might be...
And you would wonder, well, how come they can't correct them themselves, right?
Yeah.
Well, they needed us. They needed us when the genome was still intact.
And so that explains all of the activity back here at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
Or most of it.
Exactly, and explains abductions on those J-Rods that were not part of the Republic, who wanted to continue their own agenda.
And there's more than one agenda with them.
And more than one agenda with them. And then we have other races with other agendas. They have nothing whatsoever to do with that, except if they are part of the treaty process, they're here to assist in the solution. Now this sounds all like science fiction, and
it's a great miniseries.
Yeah, and as far as we know, we have we're going beyond anything we can verify. But you're asking me, what are they saying? This is what they're saying.
Yeah, that's basically what I wanted to get at.
And prior to that, they're, you know, like the latest thing coming out is the Alien Exchange Program. Well, I've known about that for some years, but now some people are leaking out details that we sent 12 people to their planet. They sent aliens here to help us out. We sent them there to get an education. They stayed there, I think it was 20 years, and 8 of the 12 came back.
The other 4 didn't want to, or they didn't live?
They didn't live, for some reason or another. Yeah, it could be accident, natural causes, whatever.
And so in closing here, you talked to Dan Burrish. He's given you interviews. Is he going to give other people interviews later, you think?
When he is done with this debriefing process, which he's estimating in another 4 months, he'll open the door to the interview.
Because it seems to me that he's kind of responsible in many ways of people taking pot shots at him because he's not available. You know what I mean?
Well, right now it's lucky it's just pot shots. Mm-hmm. When it turns into real shots and he has to duck and cover, then he can become concerned.
I just may come
to that.
Well, that is the first inclination I had about it.
There's going to be people that don't like what he has to say.
First question our staff beat around when this first came out a couple of years ago was, why is this guy still alive?
Well, of course.
Why is he?
I mean, one time, you know, he was, you might say, physically mistreated, like a warning, you know, get into line. But because he has been endeared to one of the overseers, I'll call him, he's gotten off the hook. And now they're seeing that he indeed has the facility of getting the public's attention, and they're going to use him in that way. But again, like I said, there's different factions who want to get out the story. They all have their own... you might say scenarios to report, and their own spin, because they want to control the spin. They want to control what the public is going to believe. But in the long run, it's the big guys that are going to have the last say-so.
In summary here, what do you think is going to happen in 2006 after he does all his research? Will people believe him, or will he be completely discounted?
We're going to wait and see. What I'm seeing now is more and more people will come forward, and people have come forward in the past to support him. I have heard privately from other individuals who said they also work for Majestic, and they know Dan, and they know he is has worked for them, and they will support him. If necessary, they will testify in a court of law. And Dan himself has signed a notarized statement to the effect that he has been involved with Majestic, that he has witnessed the J-Rod, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's already been submitted to a court of law in Canada, and he's willing to have it submitted to a court of law here in the United States, and call your witnesses. And he'll have witnesses called who will testify on his behalf. So even the skeptics among other insiders who work for the DIA or other agencies who do not believe Dan because they don't have a record of him, they don't have access to what he had access to, could also be challenged when he comes forward and still stands by his word. And nobody will ever find a shred of proof that there was some kind of a hoax or fraud involved, because there isn't. And as you've seen, there's many witnesses. Even his mother and father support his story.
Yes. And, you know, we're going to continue with more shows on this subject. Bill, it's been a fascinating hour or so. And
okay.
We'll be looking forward to the book, Project Aquarius. And
yes.
I know you're on top of the story, and we'll stay in touch.
Okay, Jerry.
Okay. Thank you very much.